There are some handouts I see being passed around. Now, I think, Eric, you had, you said 25 copies or something?
Yeah, about 25 copies. I just want to make sure that the panel gets some, and then they can be distributed, and then,
So, is any have other tables got this yet, or no? No. Maybe the panel can share their copies or something a little bit, and we can get these put up on the website as well. So, oh, okay, great. So, just to remind folks, these are the questions, and so what we're going to do is, got the little timer on the watch here. So the first question, what is the strength of evidence that changes in Chinook abundance cause or do not cause changes in southern resident killer whale vital rates? And each person can speak for up to 5 minutes on that. And we'll go through all of question one first, and then we'll get to question two, which are the effective changes in fisheries, and then question three, which are the most critical data needs going forward. And Dave Bernard just asked me to, was this figure you were referring to? Yeah, so I talked about this morning. This is sort of a decision tree of going down where you need to have a plausible mechanism, you need to have exposure to the stress, you need to have some correlation with that stressor, in this case, low abundance or of Chinook, some threshold for the effect, some specificity in terms of how the effect's manifested. And I mean, the more evidence you have as you go down here, the better, essentially. Hard to do experiments with its critter. And if you can remove the stress, do you see improvement? So without any other algorithm, why don't I just start with Jim, first to my left. You have 5 minutes. Go.
You know, I was really thinking we would at least get coffee or cookie, you know, before we got to start, but I better not cut into my time. But anyway, I didn't actually follow through this protocol too closely, but obviously they are exposed to Chinook. There is correlation, and the threshold, I think, kind of falls apart there. But everybody agrees that southern resident killer whales feed heavily on Chinook salmon. So, I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I personally am unconvinced from the evidence that's been presented that changes in Chinook abundance would cause any changes in the southern resident killer whale rates. Now, it's kind of interesting because the population growth is correlated with the Park and Cope Chinook Index, the abundance index, but not abundance indices for individual stocks. And it seems to me that the correlation is largely driven or strongly influenced by that one period of low Chinook abundances in the 1990s. So I haven't looked at the data just to see whether the ups are, you know, whether it's just that one low period that's kind of drawing, you know, influencing the correlation. But anyway, there's two explanations. One is that it's causal. And if you think of these killer whales as sampling the coastwide Chinook in proportion to their actual abundance. So before it to be causal, they'd have to be out there, and they're just sort of a sampling program, and they're sampling all these Chinook more or less in proportion to their abundance. But they don't do that, right? I mean, some of those populations in the Park and Cope model are not available to them. They're just not there at the right place and time. And we know that killer whales are extremely selective. So it just doesn't kind of make sense. It's curious to me that the correlation works with that estimate of overall abundance. But the other thing I just want to point out is that, you know, killer whales are a big predator. They've got big stomachs. They can obviously eat a lot, but there's only so much that they can consume, right? So that one would expect, if you're looking at that graph that you had on the lower part of the handout, that the relationship, if it doesn't exist, would be that asymptotic one, so that top one. So that at high Chinook abundances, the influence, you know, of Chinook abundance on the vital rates would be minimal or nil. So anyway, it just seems to me if there is a causal relationship, we should have seen you know, better correlations with some of the individual populations. But as Eric was pointing out, I wasn't at the second workshop, so I'm a little bit confused as to what the populations were. Anyway, the other option is that something else is controlling Chinook abundance. And at the first workshop, I presented some stuff, some results showing spatial and temporal patterns of surface chlorophyll, northerly upwelling wind patterns that cause upwelling in the marine environment. And then there's a recent paper by Sharma et al. That Antonio is a co-author of, that basically demonstrated different survival patterns for 8 regional clusters of Chinook salmon. So these are 8 different groups of Chinook. And what they found was that it was the local marine conditions, and in particular sea surface temperature, that was a good predictor. So I guess I'm putting in a plug here that, you know, it's possible that ocean productivity or sea surface temperature are controlling Chinook abundance, which then through the food chain is controlling killer whales. But if that was the case, I would have thought you'd see better fits to the abundance time series. So it may be, and I'm suspicious that we're not using the most appropriate salmon index, but that may be because it's not available. But it's also possible that there's some separate mechanism out there. And it just seems to me that we should have been investing more time and energy into more of an ecosystem modeling approach, just to try and look at, you know, other factors in the ecosystem besides Chinook that may be controlling killer whale abundance. Thank you.
Great. 30-second spare. Well, these are not tradable permits.
Maybe I can get a cookie.
Hang on one second. Let me just. I have to start by a timer.
All right.
Okay. When I got this assignment, correlation versus causation. I certainly don't want to be presumptuous and try to tell the panel members the difference, because they could probably tell me. But in going over the evidence at hand, and particularly looking at that chart, I guess I have an observation or two to make relative to where we are in application of the scientific method. I think before you get to correlation, you need to look at exposure. In this case, that's availability to Chinook salmon. And if Chinook salmon are not available, then essentially the scientific process stops right there. And we've concentrated here on abundance indices for Chinook salmon, particularly aggregate abundance indices. But in fact, salmon don't come in aggregates as far as their biology concerns. They come in populations and stock groups. And these stock groups have different behaviors, and they're found in different places and at different times, just like the whales. So there's the question of overlap. I mean, we need to look at the overlap between the ranges of both the stock-specific populations of Chinook salmon and the southern resident killer whales. Now, Michael Ford did an excellent job on this topic yesterday. But I want to run over some of the background information again. By and large, when we did this correlation by stock, we found that the more important stocks turned out to be the far north migrating stocks. Now, the trouble with having those be essentially drivers for southern resident killer whales is that most times of the year, these stocks are well outside the winter range of the killer whales. Now, all of these far north migrating stocks have to move south, and they get close to the southern resident killer whale, and in fact, they do overlap to some degree. However, by and large, as the far north migrating stocks enter into the corridor past the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the whales are primarily inside the Strait of Juan de Fuca and inside of Puget Sound feeding. I'd like to take two far north migrating stocks as an example, the Northern Oregon coastals and also the Fraser fish. The Fraser fish are definitely exposed. I mean, the adults, as they mature, go through Puget Sound, and we know that they're eaten. Now, there's no evidence that the North Oregon coastal stocks are being consumed, at least not evidence like we see for the Fraser stocks. However, then arguments have been made that the whales will dash out into the open ocean and start eating on Oregon stocks. And therefore, they are part and parcel of their diet. Well, perhaps so. However, we know for sure that that's not the case for one of the pods. The J-pod resides primarily and almost exclusively inside Puget Sound. So right now you've got about one-fourth of the population that can't be driven by a far north migrating stock. So this makes the idea of the correlation rather dubious for the far north migrating stocks. And when you add to that that you have the Fraser stocks, which for all intents and purposes are not correlated with an abundance index, yet we know that they're eaten. Same thing with the Puget Sound stocks. The correlation we have for them, well, we don't have one. And even though they are in the location of the whales seem to ignore them in favor of the Fraser stocks. Now, I'd like to tie this in a little bit with material that Sandy O'Neill provided yesterday on her fingerprint analysis. I found it very interesting that when she looked at the whales, one of the major fingerprints that she found was that from California, indicating at least the possibility in a naive fashion that these whales are eating California fish. Now, California fish have been notable by their exclusion in this workshop. We've seen simulation after simulation and correlation after correlation, but those fish are essentially not included. At the same token, her results, and she can correct me if I'm wrong because I'm winging this from memory, is that she didn't find any signature for the Fraser fish. She did for the Puget Sound. However, the Puget Sound fish have a signature that's similar to the Columbia. And in Columbia, we do have a significant correlation with the lower Columbia stock. And it is found within the range, the winter range, of the whales. I find it rather ironic that perhaps there is a dependency between southern resident killer whales and their prey, and being Chinook salmon. But it happens to be the wrong stocks that we're looking at here. Bingo. I didn't need to take
that. It's cruel to be a timekeeper. I come in about be doing this.
Well, were you convinced or
not? Was there any?
I didn't really seem to say where he really stood.
So, John.
This is tough. I tried to follow my instructions to go through these six different types of evidence as portrayed in that paper. So I started with plausible mechanisms. We all know Chinook are really important to these animals. There's little data that ground fish, things like that, represent a significant part of their diet. So I think we could argue that the resident killer whale ecotype has evolved as a Chinook specialist predator. It makes sense. It's a large, energetically rich species that's found year-round on the continental shelf in their range. Historically, Chinook were probably far more abundant than they are today. Their body mass is also larger, something that hasn't really come up much in these discussions. So I think this is consistent with the worldwide populations of killer whales, which time and again have been shown to be have a propensity for ecological specialization on particular prey types. These are fixed behavioral traditions that are somewhat invariant to change. I think it's also important to remember that these are the apex marine predators. Killer whales have no predators themselves, so ultimately they're going to be limited by bottom-up processes, food limitation. So I think a plausible scenario with these killer whales where Chinook may influence vital rates is one that I think is involved in the declines in the late 1990s. That's where the availability of Chinook on a range-wide scale abruptly drops for a prolonged period. If it's insufficient to meet the whale's energetic requirements, especially in winter when things are probably tough, they may increase their foraging on alternative prey, but this may not be profitable enough to offset nutritional stress, which accumulates, leads to the metabolism of blubber reserves, which liberates PCBs that are otherwise sequestered in their blubber in a benign manner. PCBs are a known immunosuppressant, and they're found in high levels in these animals, and it may lead to synergistic effects causing poorer health and increased mortality. Okay, next, the exposure to the causal factor. Whales range throughout the range of Chinook widely. We know that southern resident killer whales are found over 2,500 kilometers of coastline. Their movement patterns are what would be expected of a Chinook specialist, especially we see this in the northern residents. There are details I can't get into. The next correlation consistency, well, we've gone through various efforts to correlate or look more closely at correlations between Chinook and resident killer whale vital rates. When we started this analysis, we looked purely at an index of mortality and fecundity based on the observed versus expected mortality rates, using as the expected values the rates we saw in over a 20-year period of recovery of the population, starting in the mid-70s, going to the mid-90s when everything changed. We saw that mortality indices during that last 5 years of the 90s and 2000 were 2 to 3 times higher than mortality rates during that period of growth, which was a huge change. I believe that what is important to focus on here is that period in the late 90s is unlike anything else that has taken place in the time series. Unprecedented multiple years in a row of low Chinook abundance, multiple years of high mortality, low fecundity. I think that the killer whales are fairly resilient, likely resilient to 1 or 2 years of poor feeding conditions. But when there are multiple years, that leads to a cumulative nutritional stress and possibly effects on vital rates. Finally, the experiments. Not, these aren't really experiments per se, but I wanted to focus on the other lines of evidence that Chinook abundance affects the social structure, activity budget, foraging success, body condition, and so on. And these, I think, in total support the hypothesis of there being a direct connection. The photogrammetry studies that John Durbin went over yesterday, pointing towards potentially retarded growth in animals that were developing during the late 90s, during this potentially lean period compared to older animals. Also the peanut head condition, there's 13 known cases. This peanut head, of course, is a precursor to mortality and as a sign of emaciation. Of the 13 cases during 76 to 2008, 8 of these occurred during the years in the late 90s of low Chinook abundance. And there's also a few published studies that show a significant relationship between social structure and Chinook availability. Lusso et al. Found that group sizes were small in northern residents in Johnson Strait during years of low Chinook catch per unit effort in the test fishery over a long time period. Kim Parsons et al. In 2009 and Foster et al. A paper in Press and Animal Behavior found that social bond strength, rate of association in southern resident killer whales increased significantly with Chinook abundance, getting closer. Concluding then, so several lines, the most parsimonious explanation to me is, for the strong correlation is between Chinook and mortality and birth rates. Of the known threats to the resident killer whales, none provides a plausible explanation. And I think to dismiss Chinook salmon as playing a key role in resident killer whale survival and recovery is inconsistent with a precautionary approach to their conservation.
Well, 5 words per minute. Thank you. Okay. Sorry, Stacey. Scott, thank you. Go ahead.
To be clear, I'm here speaking for myself and not for DFW. In terms of dependence on Chinook, I think it's clear May through September diet is presented both in Hansen et al. And Ford and Ellis is dominated by Chinook. January to July diet is also dominated by Chinook, and that's based on fecal data, HTS cloning. scales and tissues, and then also some indication from stable isotopes. And it appears to be fairly constant among years. However, there's spatial bias in that sampling. But they're clearly eating other things, and particularly in that October to December window where there's more chump. Also, there's thyroid hormone data suggests that the Columbia River and early Fraser Chinook abundance is important to killer whales. And they seem to be selecting large Chinook, and that's based on the scale data. And it's also based on the Fort Ellis paper where you looked at use versus availability. So then what's the evidence for, it appears that Chinook's important, and the evidence seems to support that. So what's the relationship between killer whale vital rates and indices of Chinook abundance? Well, we can't do experiments, so we can't look at cause and effect. And like in most wildlife and fisheries world, we're really caught with looking at correlations and strengths of correlation. So we have to look at what is the strength of the relationship. Eric used a model selection process, a typical approach that we often use, and he looked at, in his 2009 paper, he looked at oceanographic effects, all kinds of different effects on southern resident killer whale vital rates. And the one thing that comes out strongly is Chinook abundance, and it's clearly supported by an AIC selection process. You could also look at evidence ratios as is described in Burnham and Anderson. I don't think it's necessary. I think Eric provides some nice cutoffs. And it also makes sense in terms of what we know about the biology of the animal. Antonio's regression analysis, I really haven't had time to digest very well. We just got those tables and we saw them briefly. And so I really haven't had time to think about it carefully. But again, we see the same relationship, but that's not surprising because we're using the same data. So if there wasn't a correlation with Chinook abundance, I guess I'd be pretty surprised. So the correlation makes biological sense. However, the effect appears to be very small, quite small, and that's surprising. And that's shown in some of the stuff we looked at today and yesterday. If we look at elasticity and the percent of the change in the CV and population growth. But also we can look at the probability if we're using a Bayesian approach. And so that's really what we're stuck with in terms of how to evaluate the evidence. And so I guess I feel fairly convinced that there is a relationship, that the relationship makes biological sense, and but that relationship appears to be quite weak. Are there any thresholds? Well, there's really not evidence for that. There were the biggest effects in early years when there was high variability in salmon numbers and when exploitation rates were high, suggesting that maybe when numbers get to be low, there may be some sort of a threshold, but we can't really look at it. We're dealing with a species with really extremely, with vital rates that don't respond quickly, and so we're not likely to detect it. We're also doing extremely small sample sizes. At least on the killer whale side of things, the equation. And then the last thing to think about in my mind is that we have extremely good data on one side of the equation, the killer whale data, and we have extremely poorer data on the fish side of the equation, when you put fish over here on the side of the equation, with very high CV rates. And that's worrisome to me. I'm not sure how to deal with those errors associated with the fish. I wish we had better data. We don't.
Great. Let's start. On time.
I was thinking about going last, and these guys stole my punchlines.
Look at that. Maybe. Go ahead, Eric.
All right. I think it was worth thinking about separating out the question into two parts. And so what's my confidence that this is we're dealing with a salmon problem, a predator-prey problem, versus we're dealing with a Chinook-specific problem. So I think what we've learned so far is that the northern resident and southern resident populations are very highly correlated. I took John's data that he presented, the first talk of his in workshop one, and just kind of rescaled it in figure one in this handout I sent out just to illustrate the correlation in a slightly different way. And like you said, there's a, you know, the populations are very correlated. It's about 0.65, and I couldn't do a five-minute talk without doing simulations. So the probability of two populations that are monitored over 30 years being that correlated or more is about 1 in 4,300. So it's not chance correlation. And I think the panel did a good job in the draft report identifying in two or three places that there's probably a common causal factor that's affecting these populations. So what is that factor? I think the other key point is going back to my work for workshop two, I talked about the Moran effect. And the Moran effect in ecology says that if you have two populations that are demographically correlated, they're either correlated because of migration and dispersal or because of a similar response to the environment. And so we know these populations are not connected via migration, dispersal, inbreeding. So it has to be a similar response to the environment. And so what is it about their environments that's similar? I think it's also worth identifying what about their environments are different. And so there's factors like vessel traffic and urban noise or other anthropogenic factors that differ between environments, exposure to contaminants, density dependence, and I mean that although we can't say specifically what the carrying capacity is for each population, we know that the probability that the two populations are at the same fraction of carrying capacity, so 60% or 85% or 95%, is essentially zero. So if these fluctuations are due to density dependence, they have to be at the same fraction of carrying capacity, and they're most likely not. So the other issue is genetics and inbreeding and historical harvest, which are different between populations, and those are unlikely to be the common primary driver for what's determining the dynamics. As John said, I think in the absence of any kind of commercial harvest, apex predators like killer whales are only regulated by intrinsic processes like density dependence, competition, or bottom-up trophic effects. And so I think it's pretty likely that it's a bottom-up trophic effect. We know that everything that we've seen so far based on isotopes, based on the genetic ID from fecal samples, and based on the scale data that John and Brad have been collecting, the diet's consistent with nearly 100% salmon diet. So I think I'm really pretty confident that this is a predator-prey issue, that it's a salmon story. Then going to the next step, is this a Chinook problem? And I think we have our best information, unfortunately, as Scott said, in really the May to October window, where Chinook does appear to be a pretty dominant player, but we know very little about winter diet. I think that there's the two scale samples. There's the two scale samples in winter so we know very little about winter diet. And so I think really for me what I struggle with in thinking about the Chinook question is we really don't know what seasons are important or most important or limiting to killer whales. We don't know which species the whales might be specializing on during this limiting period. So we've seen the shift to chum. Other species might be important at different times of the year. Which stocks they're specializing on during this limiting period. And then I think one of the impossible questions that we probably will never be able to address is, has this limiting period or the important species changed over time? Because we don't have much in the way of historical data. So I think everything that we've seen summarized is consistent with this being a salmon story. I'm less confident that it's 100% Chinook story.
Great. How about we give a round of applause for all of you? I'll give them a chance to catch their breath before question two. So let me just take the pulse of it. We can go straight into question two, or we can grab a coffee and come back.
Coffee.
Coffee? Okay. So let's 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Okay, and then we'll back to the floor. Good job. After all of these questions have been answered by the panel, there'll be a 1-hour discussion. But we want to get all the answers from the panel first.